Okay, so with soft light, you imagine that you've got someone in camera, like me, okay, and I'm lit now with a hard light. So can you see the sides of my face here getting darker?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, if that light, instead of it being a small circle of light, if it was a wide light in front of me, then the sides of my face would be equally illuminated, which means that my face would have a visual appearance of looking wider. Soft light makes people's faces look wider. That's it.
Hey, welcome to episode 342 of the Beginner Photography Podcast, brought to you by CloudSpot, the easiest way to deliver and sell your photos online. I'm your host, Raymond Hatfield, and today we are chatting with BBC-trained lighting expert and photographer Damien Lovegrove about the secrets of effectively capturing light. Now, as many of you know, I studied motion film before transitioning into photography, so we were taught the basics of camera movement, lighting, framing, things like that. But the truth is, when I graduated, with the writers having been on strike, actors having been on strike, I just didn't get as much real-world practice with light and camera movements as I wish that I would have, like Damien here today. I mean, you know, almost 10 years of learning to frame and light people for broadcast TV, you know, and that is a full stack of knowledge that he was able to bring and apply to his photography to produce just jaw-dropping results that you have to see to believe. And today, he lets us inside of his head to share with us how he sees and uses light in photography. You're going to love it. With that, let's go ahead and get on into today's interview with Damien Lovegrove. Damien, my first question for you is an easy one. When did you know that photography was going to play an important role in your life?
I think it was October 1983.
Oh, that's very specific. That's the most specific I've heard from somebody.
Yes. It's when I applied to the BBC as a cameraman, to become a cameraman or to train to become a cameraman. And they asked me for my portfolio. I didn't have a portfolio, so I went out and shot a portfolio. And that process of taking one roll of 36 Ilford FP4 and putting it through my Rolly 35 was a really interesting process, because I learned so much about photography at that point. I mean, I'd already understood the basics, you know, about shutter speed and aperture, etc. And it was a case of going out there and shooting for a specific project. And I really liked that, because until that point, when I was out with a camera, I was just wandering with the camera in hand, waiting for something fabulous to appear in front of me so that I could take a picture of it. And so it was a fairly aimless process. But once I had a project, once I knew what I wanted to achieve, it was actually really great, great fun. And with that little Rolly 35, I had to be careful, because it didn't have autofocus back in those days, and it wasn't even an SLR. So I had to make sure I got the focus right on every shot. And I think I had 24 finished prints, which I'd made in my makeshift darkroom over in my bathroom at home. And they were put them into a little A4 folder and took them with me, and I got the job.
You got the job. Wow. First of all, 24 out of 36, extremely high hit rate. So congratulations. So obviously, like, to that point, you had been shooting before that moment. So, like, what was it that got you? And you wanted to be a cameraman. So there was some sort of something within you that was interested in creating imagery. Where did that come from?
Yes. Well, my mother was an artist, a teacher at school, at a secondary school, teaching ages 11 till 17, teaching art. And my father was an architect, and my brother, 7 years older than me, was a full-time photographer, photographing buildings and architecture for architects and developers. So the photography and art and craft and light and tone and color and all those things were part of my vocabulary at that point. So I was 19 at that stage. And that was, you know, it was quite straightforward to pick up those processes. And being sort of into physics and optics and things, I was pretty switched on as well regarding the technology and the understanding of, you know, selecting the shutter speed and things. Now, you mentioned that quite a good hit rate. Now, of course, working on film, each frame probably in today's money, each frame probably costs something like 40 pence to actually take a frame and have it processed. And so if you're on a small budget, as I was as a 19-year-old, you had to make sure that every frame mattered. And so I used a tripod for all the shots in that set, and I put the camera on a tripod, and it was across a lake, perhaps at a manor house the other side of the lake, and some swans swimming by, and I work out where my thirds were and decide where I want to put my horizon and make sure the camera's up right, then focus at the point I wanted it to be in focus. So I've got to tick all these boxes. It's a process you go through. And then you set your shutter speed for the scene and your aperture for the scene, and you decide what's that, and make sure everything ticks in with the ISO. Now, of course, on film, ISO was fixed at those days. So you had to basically decide, well, you know, a minimum shutter speed might be 125th, or if you've got, you know, some movement in the scene. And then you adjust your aperture to taste. And there's a little needle on the top of the camera, a little bat and ball, and you had to sort of line the two up. So you, as long as you understood which of your three exposure elements was going to be the controlling one for the brightness and the exposure of the picture, you're away. And that's how it was. It didn't really leave anything to chance. And you pressed the button, and then you move on. You don't bracket the exposures or anything. So that was a process. And of course, I still shoot like that today. Every picture that I take is taken on a tripod. And I go through that process of deciding, of course, in digital world, we can adjust the ISO between pictures. So nearly always now, the ISO is my controlling factor for how bright or dark I want the image. So it's a different kind of process because we're in a digital environment and you can see the picture before you press the button. But still, you know, there's not necessarily any reason to take a second or third photograph if you've got it in the first take.
Yeah, well, it's easier to know now on digital than it was on film if you knew that you got it. You could have a good idea whether or not you got it, obviously with moment and hoping to meet the light. But now with digital, I'm always interested to know, from somebody who learned photography on film, do you think that, you know, for those who today are learning on digital, do you think that there's something that is missing, or do you think that it's just a different learning curve?
I don't think there's something missing. I just think it's working on film slows you down. That's the first thing. And so that's partly why I mimic that by using a tripod for everything. I light all my work, and I set the scene. I get the verticals upright in camera, etc. So I do all that hard work up front, and then take pictures. And then create the moment or what have you. Now, working on film, it's all just as important, because a lot of the time when I was working in the 1980s and 1990s, I was supplying pictures for photo libraries in London and some commercial clients, and everything was shot on transparency. And so what you see is what you get, and there's no cropping of the frame. You can't go in and just zoom in a little bit and crop later. The transparency shows everything and the client gets to see everything. So it was very important to get all those elements right. And if you're a wealthy photographer back in the day, you could use something called a Polaroid back and get an instant idea of what your picture is going to look like. Although the image quality was always very disappointing.
Sure.
But then, of course, that takes away your profit if you're working as a professional, you know, usually having to Polaroid everything. But in the digital world, it's a different feel. You've got, because you can preview, I mean, obviously in 2010 when mirrorless came in, it was a massive difference, because with SLR, you take a picture and then you have to press play and look back to see what you've taken. With a mirrorless camera, you see the picture before you press the button. And so it takes out a big element of mystery. But also it allows you to be really creative. You can increase the exposure by 3 or 4 stops on something, just let it really scream into the highlights and just knock it back a bit to pull back some detail. And you've got maybe a high key, beautiful piece of art that you would never have taken the risk shooting on film. You couldn't have got captured that in camera. So, but the beauty of working with film, of course, is the not necessarily the capture stage. The beauty is in the printing. Optical printing was the great thing, you know, actually going straight from a negative onto a photographic paper. These days with shoot and dev and scan and then working in a digital environment at the end is just not the same. You know, there's no reason really to capture in film, apart from perhaps a bit of nostalgia and the cameras look cool and, right. and things. And, you know, sometimes it's surprising what triggers someone's excitement enough to hold a hobby or an interest. And by having a really nice old 1960s Leica or even a Russian Zorky camera or something and going out and shooting on the street and feeling, taking the time to consider the exposure and going through that analog process can be the trigger for a really enjoyable hobby. So in the same way, some people like to play LPs rather than CD. It's that process of getting up and putting the record on and just sitting back down and listening to 22 minutes of you know, music uninterrupted.
Of course.
So yeah, it's really what make it's up to you to determine what really is going to trigger that enthusiasm and sustain that the enthusiasm necessary to learn and to get good, because it's in that process of improving in your output, proving in the photographs that you take, that gives you that motivation to continue. And I've been doing that now since, as I say, 1984 was when I started in photography. And it's my hobby and my passion and my interest now, some 40 odd years later.
Yeah, that's great to hear you say that, because I know that we have a listener who, Shane, he's listening right now. So when it comes to photography, he got into it with digital. I think now he has professional grade Canon body, an R6 or something like that with all the glass. But for the past 4 or 5, maybe 6 months, all of his photos have been from an old, one of the last Canon Rebel film cameras that they make that, cost, just a handful of dollars, not much at all. But he's been spending so much time with that. And, you know, it's been great to see his growth in photography through film that it almost seemed like his work in digital plateaued a bit. So, as you said, there's something about that enthusiasm about the film and the shooting it and the getting it back that is, that can be infectious. That can be infectious for sure. But getting back to you, back to you, I really want to know more about your story. And because you went to become a cameraman for the BBC for motion film for TV, right? When did you get into photography? It was commercial work, right? Hey, Raymond here. If you're sometimes baffled by which camera settings to use, then I've got just the thing for you. My free guide, Picture Perfect Camera Settings. It's a fantastic starting point for anybody eager to understand the basics of camera settings in various shooting scenarios. And it's tailored to beginners who want to get out of auto mode, providing clear, easy-to-follow suggestions on where to start with your settings. So whether you're capturing a stunning landscape or a family portrait, Picture Perfect Camera Settings will help you to get off of automatic mode and explore the possibilities your camera offers. Remember, mastering photography settings is a journey, and this guide is your first step and the perfect resource to guide you towards finding the right settings for your style. So grab your copy today at perfectcamerasettings.com and start your journey to better photos.
Well, yes, in 1984, BBC took me on, and it took me 3 years to learn the process to become a cameraman. I was a trainee assistant cameraman initially, and then another 3 years to become a lighting cameraman, and then another 3 years to become a lighting director. So 9 years of training to get to that stage. And then there was a big change in the environment at the BBC. A lot of people were made redundant. I lost my job, but I got a job in news, and so I became a news cameraman. But all the way through that professional career, I had a hobby, a principal hobby, and that was photography. And throughout those years, as I progressed in my quality of the work I was doing for photo libraries in London and other places, the that hobby grew, and my experience and my talent and all the other elements of it grew to the extent that I felt I could leave the BBC. And in 1998, I did, to become a full-time stills photographer. So that was the point where I decided that the art, working in within the news environment in television wasn't enough. You know, I needed that a little bit more of an artistic control. So I started shooting stills for commercial companies like Peugeot, Motorola, Parker Pens, you know, a lot of Adidas, you know, big companies and corporations. But I was pretty rubbish at getting the money in. It was always a faff. And also the photography, you know, where you do a really thorough job and what you consider to be a great job of photographing someone's product, and you barely get a thank you. You know, it's just you're a line, an expense on a spreadsheet for someone. So that really didn't tick my boxes. And so I then went into what I call retail photography, photographing people. But the people in the picture were the people that were buying the pictures. And that was my weddings and portraits. And that's when it suddenly changed for me. I realized that I wanted to be hugged at the end of a wedding. Oh, my word, you're amazing. And then when they see the pictures of their friends and their loved ones, their tears flow because they're just so, you know, suddenly photography had a value, and it was being valued. And I had a skill that I could embrace and enjoy. And I shot 400 weddings in a process. I paid my mortgage, and it was very, you know, very lucrative. But I never lost the fun of photographing people and being with people. So my that goodness, was the 400 motivation weddings. For my photography.
400 weddings, 400 weddings. I just wrapped up my career, my very short career as a wedding photographer. I'd been shooting for about 10 years, and I only shot just a handful over 100 weddings. And I thought to myself, wow, that's a lot of weddings. But to hear 400 weddings is phenomenal and almost, you know, awe-inspiring. And I want to know, in that time, okay, so obviously you were accomplished when it came to, you knew how to use a camera and you knew how to use light. But when you think about that first wedding that you shot, and then you think about one of the last weddings that you shot, what do you think was the biggest area of growth that you made in your photography?
Probably the ability to direct, I think. I'd worked in television for, you know, a large number of years at that time. And I learned from some of the great directors of the day. And it was fantastic watching artistic directors. And I learned how to pose people in a way that I could capture pictures of the two of them in love and the connection between them, and not the connection between them and the camera. So it was a case of being able to create, a bit like a director of on a theater stage or a movie director, you're creating a scene in front of you which is completely fictitious, but you're making it look realistic. And that was part of what I had, which I could offer. And with weddings, I think after the first 20 or so, I'd realized that I needed to become much more narrow and focused in my style. So what I did was quite unique in a way, because together with my wife, we worked out that what we wanted to do was carry forward that cinematic style. Now, when you shoot for movies, for cinema, the camera is always at a height of the sort of shirt pocket or just above the waist. And it's always looking up to people, actors. And so it has that lovely sort of makes them look tall and powerful. And you have this aperture which is fixed. So when you're working with film and you have fixed apertures, you've got to keep swapping out ND filters to maintain that aperture. And that's what they do on movie sets. So they might shoot for 6 months to create one movie. Everything is shot at F4 or F2.8 because it has a consistent look and feel. So for 10 years, I shot every wedding at F4.
The whole day?
So every picture of every wedding was what was F4. Oh, and wow. We used to set our cameras to 800 ISO and leave it at 800 ISO, leave it at F4, and just tweak the shutter speed to suit the moment and to suit the light level that was where we were. So an interior like the one I'm in now, or a hotel interior back in the day lit with tungsten light, was 800 ISO, a 60th at F4. And that was always the same. You know, it was about 800 lux. And that was the light level that people were comfortable with in. And so we just went from there. So
that is amazing. I know that there are a lot of people right now who are listening thinking, wait, my camera goes up to 3200 and that's never enough. You know, and here you are shooting every wedding around 800 ISO. Obviously, there are times where you just don't simply have enough light. The exposure is absolutely just too low.
Now, bear in mind, we finished shooting weddings in about 2010. Mm-hmm. And since then, LED lighting has taken over the world, interiors. And what's more, we've gone, all our interiors now that we consider to be comfortable interiors are about one stop darker than they were. So that's worth bearing in mind. So you're down to about 400 lux in a modern place. And so candles look lovely and everything has got slightly warm and beautiful glow in the evenings. And so now I would be sitting at my camera basically at 1600 ISO or 3200. But we never went from F4 down to 2.8, even though our lenses did, because at F4 we could get four eyes. You know, people, if we were looking to camera, we could get all the eyes in the same focal plane and get them sharp. So it wasn't a photograph of the groom where the bride is slightly out of focus, or a photograph of the bride but a groom slightly out of focus. So we could work that. Plus you still had out of focus backgrounds. You still had that separation with focus at F4. And so it was a consistent look right the way through the album. And and it was part of a process. It was part of a product that we were producing. But mm-hmm. I think sometimes simplifying things is the way to become good quickly. So for instance, I didn't have a standard lens in my camera bag. I had a wide lens and I had a tight lens. And so I go into a scene. It might be, let's say, the groom and his ushers and a best man in a hotel room, and they're sort of putting on ties and things. I think, right, okay, so I'll put a wide lens on to get the scene, the wide shot of the scene, and I tidy up the background, get rid of the bags and the half-eaten sandwiches and the bottles of beer from the night before, switch off the rugby and things and tidy everything up, get a wide shot. Then I could switch to the tighter lens and get all my close-ups. And the close-ups would include details, of course, like the best man's speech or the rings or things like that, as well as close-ups of interaction between people. So it was either a wide shot or a close-up. And then when you have an album or put up together a collection of pictures, we used to have a wide shot establishing picture, close-up, close-up, close-up. You turn the page and then it'd be paid with the bride and her bridesmaids as a wide shot, and then a close-up, close-up, close-up. So you're building a product over a period of a day which has a rhythm and that has a style which is it repeats and it's predictable and it's gorgeous. And then when the viewer of the photographs goes into and starts looking at the work, they're not looking at, it's not the photography they're looking at. They're looking at the narrative. They're looking at the story. They're looking at the elements of the day. And it's actually a really rewarding process. So if you're photographing perhaps your family or a child that's growing up from birth or even from pregnancy right the way through to a teenager, unless this is a little personal project that you've got, think about using the same lens and keep that lens for years and just work with that one lens and take pictures in certain things, like maybe in their bedroom, sitting on their bed, surrounded by the things that are important to them. And as they grow up and become teenagers, that might be an electric guitar, it might be something else, but there'll be a rhythm in the set of pictures, which will have a great value later on.
Hey, Raymond here, and we will get back to today's interview in just a moment. In today's digital world, knowing how to edit your images is more important than ever. Now, today's top photographers around the world lean into the editing process more of as a maker's mark for their images. Now, you want a style of your own too, but you don't know where to start. That is precisely why I have created 52 free Lightroom presets for you to download right now. Presets are not a one-click solution, you know this, but they are simply the perfect teaching tool to see step-by-step how a look is created so that you can create a unique editing style all of your own as well. So download your 52 free Lightroom presets today over at freephotographypresets.com. Now, back to today's interview. I'm writing that down because that is a fantastic idea that I can imagine seeing. You know, one thing that I do, and this is obviously off topic here, but I like to just every once in a while, if I have my camera with me, I'll walk by my son's room or my daughter's room and just grab a quick photo of it. You know, whether it's messy, whether it's clean, whatever, just because I know when they turn 18, seeing, you know, 18 different photos of what their room look like is going to be different. But taking that time to get a little bit closer, maybe find the things that they're interested in. Right now, my son is really into geography, so maybe some books that he's really into, a rock tumbler. I could see how those would add context and really make an impact as they get older. So I appreciate that. When it comes to going to a wedding, like we talked about, you know, you have your base exposure that you try to go with. But one of the things that you're very well known for is your use of light, your use of flash, and just like really making compelling images with light. And that's one of the things that new photographers struggle with the most. You know, I mean, when you say, you know, you have to learn to see the light, their first response is, I see it everywhere. It's light. What do you mean? You know, how do we kind of develop that eye to see light in a more critical sense? There are two ways to bring home more money with your photography business. You either get more clients or you spend less of the money that you make. CloudSpot Studio helps you keep more of what you earn. With the lowest payment processing fees in the industry, the average photographer will save $300 annually. And that's just more money to invest in essential gear like a new flash or a sweet camera bag. You know, one that is perfect for storing all of the wedding day snacks that you can pack. But it's not just about savings. CloudSpot Studio is designed to streamline your workflow. Easily organize shoots, send contracts, questionnaires, invoices, and you're really going to enjoy the hassle-free payments. So sign up for a free CloudSpot account at deliverphotos.com. And as a bonus, you're going to get access to my exclusive wedding and portrait contracts and questionnaires at no additional cost. Why let fees chip away at your profits? Empower your photo journey with CloudSpot and watch your business soar.
Okay, I think the first thing is it's not necessarily being able to see the light, although that is a phrase that everyone uses. It's being able to take control of light. So in this situation here, for instance, I've got a light, a key light, which is lighting me. I've got a backlight giving me a bit of rim light, and there's some background, and I've set the background lighting is at fixed level. So I set my exposure, which is the MacBook Pro camera on that, and I adjust my other lights to suit. It's quite straightforward. And when shooting weddings, I used to take an Arri 300, watt Fresnel lens light and then take it on, put on a stand. And we're at the reception venue, you sort of nip up to the bride and groom's bedroom, set that up there. And then when that was all rigged and set, we used to come down and get the bride and groom from their reception and take them up and do some lovely pictures, very Hollywood-esque style pictures. And once you've got a light, you can pan it around and control it and do what you want with it. It's fantastic. But I mean, we weren't working with soft light. We were working with hard light. So, and that was part of the process. But what you can do at home without even having any lights is to go into a room, close the curtains, close the shutters, if you've got shutters, close the door, and start with a black space. Then open the one curtain just a bit and look at the way that the light comes through, that slash of light, the way it dances across the bed or the way it hits the room. Because the whole room stays subdued, but there's a pool of light that comes in. Just by closing the curtains and opening them a little bit, you create shape with the light. And then you sit a bride there on the edge of the bed with that light coming in from the curtains. Looks fantastic. Whereas if all the curtains are wide open, just looks like a bride sitting on a bed in a bedroom. So it's taking control of light. Sometimes it's about what you remove rather than what you put in.
Oh, wow. Sometimes it's what you remove rather than put in. So when it comes to, light, right, obviously, so it's not just about blasting a scene full of light. That is not going to get you anywhere.
That's illuminating.
Right. That is illuminating.
And that's what you do if you put your flash on camera with a Stofen or whatever, and the flash zooms out, it illuminates the scene. Now, with a flash on camera, of course, it's quite a hard light, and it can look very fashionable, especially if you've got people coming out of a nightclub or all dressed up for an evening. They are publishable works of art. Often. And you often see people's work, famous photographers, Testino, people like that. And you look at the picture and you think, well, that's just flash on camera. So that's all it needs to be. It doesn't have to be. It just has to be considered, if that makes sense. But you can also, as soon as you start putting soft boxes and big umbrellas and things, then you start to lose an element of control. And then it's hard to fight and bring that back. Because, of course, window is not the light source. You can't replace a window with a softbox and expect it to be a light source, because it's not. The window is just a hole that the light comes through, and the light comes from the sky beyond. And so another way of working is to put, when I'm shooting interiors and things, I put a light outside on the patio or in the garden, in the yard, set it up and pump it through the window, make my sunlight where I want it to be. So I can be on the north side of a building in the northern hemisphere make it a sunny room. Even if it's on the first floor or the second floor or what have you, just use a tool stand for that process. But quite often I'm putting light in from outside rather than lighting from within the space, if that makes sense.
It does. It does. Okay. So taking control of light is the most important thing that we should take away from what you're saying here. What is the balance then? Because I know that a lot of new wedding photographers, and myself included, I shot almost all of my weddings without an assistant or anybody. It was just me. So I had to play this game of do I need to bring out the flash and set it up for the shot, or can I get away with just a base exposure here? So how did you kind of run through that that question?
Well, the majority of pictures where we were in the evening, where we were getting photographs of a small group of people, or the bride with her brother, or bride's mother on the stairs or something, we'd use a flash, a speed light, with a Stofen. I don't know whether you know Stofen. It's like a plastic dome, and these things come included now in modern day speed lights from China. There's a white plastic dome that fits on the top, so the light that becomes like a light bulb. The light goes in all directions. It doesn't soften the light. It's not because the hardness or softness of the light is relative to the size of the light source. So it doesn't make the flash any bigger. It just means that the light goes in all directions. And then I put a coiled lead from that to the camera. Don't rely on radio triggers, because at some point they're not going to work and they'll interfere. The local taxi company will interfere with whatever. Generally speaking, I just put a cable and I have the flash in one hand with the Stofen, and I have it up high. I have the camera in the other, and I can take a picture, and I can bring the cam flash to this side or this side, depending on what I need it for. And working with that small angle of flash to camera, fantastic. And the pictures look great because you've got this crisp light, which looks lovely. And the colors of the clothing that they have is fantastic. Because you know what it's like at a wedding. There's a certain lilac or purple, and it's been chosen about as a Pantone color. And of course, in a hotel with sort of slightly muddy lighting, relatively poor LED lighting, you can lose all track of what that color is. And so by popping in a bit of consistent light from a flash gun in through the front, but allowing the ambient exposure behind to still record nicely in the image, so it's that little blend, which is 800 ISO, 60th f4, it'll be fine. Or I should say 1600 ISO, a 60th f4 these days. And a splash of flash in the front, perfect. Maybe what a third of a stop let down on the flash exposure, but it's still going to give you a point of light in the eyes. It's going to make everyone's skin look great. The colors will look fantastic. And you still can see in the background the environment they're in. It could be a Christmas tree, could be a roaring fire and a big log fire, or what have you. It could be a disco with DJ lights and lasers and things like that. That just that'll all get recorded, and just pop your splash a flash in from the front and looks good.
Well, I'm going to play devil's advocate here, because I know a lot of people are going to be thinking this question. And that is, you know, we got some cords. We got another thing to hold on to. We got some batteries to deal with. Why not just raise up our ISO? What are we getting out of a flash that we can't get from just cranking it up?
It's all about lighting, angle, and direction. Okay, so it's hard to understand. If you raise the light that's in an ambient space is normally pretty rubbish. So if you want to, like, I've chosen where I want to sit in this room. I thought, well, okay, this will be a nice place to sit. And then I've put my light in to make it look great. Whereas if I just switched the lights on in the room and then thought, well, that's maybe I'll go here. You know, we have top lights that come down, these little downlighters, the little curse of everything, because they make eyes go like black holes and there's these horrible shadows everywhere and the nose shadow comes all the way down to the chin. So there's all this stuff going on and you just want to get rid of all that. As soon as you've got your own light source, which you can bring in really close to the camera, then you can shoot anywhere. So if someone says, oh, can we have a picture in front of the Christmas tree or by the Christmas tree, or can we take a picture on the stairs, or can I have a picture in the bath, you know, to get the no water in it, but you might want to get a couple of the girls might be in there with their champagne or what have you, and it'll look great, and you can just boom, take a picture and it will look lovely. So the thing is, you really on what you want to try and achieve. I mean, when you shoot, I'm photographing weddings and things. What I'm trying to achieve is not having to think about the technology at all. So the shutter speed and the ISO and things are all set. The flash power is set. It's on a cord. Can't go wrong. So that's that sorted. So all I'm going to do is I'll put that down. I'll get the people in the right places. I might move the bouquets to put them in the background. I might get them a bit closer together. I'll create that energy and that spark. Throw a bit of laughter in there. Pick the camera up. Bang. Got my picture. So it's all about the accessories to the image that create the content. The illumination or the lighting of the content is perhaps less important, but you want something that is consistent and is going to make the skin tones and the everything look great. And if you look at, let's say, newsreaders in a studio, and you look at the lighting on their faces, it's hard light. A bit like I've got here, I've got hard light. So you can tell hard light. Look at the shadow from my hands. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's hard light.
Yeah.
Okay. The hard light is actually more flattering than soft light. But people think of soft light or think, oh, that's going to be better for the skin. But ultimately, you're going to probably Photoshop anyway. But hard light is more flattering because it's narrower on the skin. And if you get it steep enough so that you can still get it into your eyes, it will create a nice chiseled look, and it's crisp and it'll look fantastic.
Wow, I don't think anybody on the podcast has really talked about this, but I also don't think that many people have as much experience as you do with light. So can you explain that a little more? Why do so many people think that soft light is so much better than hard light? Is that the right term there?
Yeah. Okay, so with soft light, you imagine that you've got someone in camera, like me, okay, and I'm lit now with a hard light. So can you see the sides of my face here getting darker?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, if that light, instead of it being a small circle of light, it's a point of light about that diameter. If it was a wide light, that side in front of me, then the sides of my face would be equally illuminated, which means that my face would have a visual appearance of looking wider. Hmm. Soft light makes people's faces look wider. That's it. You know, you can't get around that fact. Hard light, the narrower the light source, the narrower the face looks. And when you move the camera angle away from the light and you're working with a sort of narrow angle, what you want to try and do is look into the unlit side of the face, because that's the most flattering way of working. But you want the light to come from the white onto the wider side of the face. So for instance, let's say the distance between my eye and my mouth here was smaller this side than it is that side. I'd want to light into the smaller side and then put the larger side of my face into shadow. And therefore, it'll balance it out and make the person's face look symmetrical. If someone's got a nose that's bent that way, what you do is you don't light against the bend because it makes this, you know, so it'll take the shadow across. It's hard work because I'm not looking in a mirror. I'm looking at myself on the little screen. But you understand. So I bring a light in from here. If the nose is bent that way and I bring a light in from there, the shadow will go long. But if you light into the bend, the shadow is small and it'll, in fact, it'll straighten the nose. So there's lots of, when you're photographing people, there's a lot of these little traits and things. I learned these at the BBC because I had to, you know, make sure that the actors and the performers were lit beautifully and I could recognize what their best side was. You know, when someone says, this is my best side, that means that that's the side they want to be shot from. Mm-hmm. You know, it's nearly always true. And you can tell often because someone's parting is opened on that side saying, look at me from here. So, so anyway, whatever, that aside, so all these little elements are the things that when I started out with my little Rolly 35 taking pictures for that portfolio, I had no concept of how to actually light someone, how to make someone look great, you know, how to bring out the best in them visually using tone, shade, all of those elements, whether it's going to be hard, crisp, hard light, soft light, you know, because people here will be thinking, oh, what is he talking about? Soft light's wonderful. You know, put someone near a window and have that bathed in soft light and they will look fantastic. But if you shoot it oblique so that you're not shooting the whole face, it can look great. So, you know, it's not necessarily me saying that hard light is the best. For me, it is the best. And that's why film productions all through Hollywood, right away through the CNN and BBC, all around the world. Anyway, if you want to make someone look good, use hard light. And that's how it works. That's it, really.
That was a wonderful explanation.
There's a lot to learn when you're photographing people. But the most important element isn't really the technical on whether you're using hard light or soft light and whether the light, key light is from a certain angle. Most important element is the connection with a person, the energy that you bring into the camera. And that can just be, I tend to work with mirror directing. So when I'm working on photographing a child at a wedding and there might be a 3-year-old or something, a 4-year-old, and they're sitting on the step outside the church and there's two of them, they're sitting side by side, and I get them to put an arm around each other and all the people around there with their phones are going, oh, is that so cute? And they're taking their pictures from standing up, you know, but I'm down at ground level, mm-hmm. camera down below me. And I'm going, shh. Or I'm creating a little laugh, making the laugh. I'm creating the moment. And when you look back at the picture, it's that little moment and the reaction to the photographer. So there's the photographer's input in that picture. Plus, of course, the camera's from in the right height and things like that. But what else is there? Another little tip, I suppose, is that I mentioned earlier how the camera is lower. Mm-hmm. And if you look back in the last part of the last century, some of the classic portrait pictures that are gracing the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the London Portrait Gallery and all around the world, these pictures that have been collected of the famous film stars of the time, they're all shot from below. You know, the camera's down here and it's because of waist level finders. Mm-hmm. So the photographer's got the head down looking into the finder and the lens is below them and it's looking up to, so you look up to the face and down to the feet. That's always the rule. And they look fantastic. And what I would encourage people to do is to come away from looking through the little hole. Because as soon as 35mm cameras were invented back in the wartime, you know, middle of the last century, where you look through a little hole to see the picture through a little bit of reflex there, through a little optical viewfinder. Then the camera came up to the face and people might dip their legs a little bit to think, oh, I'm getting a bit down here. But actually they're probably only moving that much.
Sure. Yeah. A few inches.
The trick is now we've got this wonderful LED or LCD displays, OLEDs or whatever. And we don't have to have the camera at eye level. Don't have to look through a little hole. And I think that's why smartphones have become so useful. Mm. You want to take a picture of a plate of food like everyone seems to do and put it on social media. You can get the camera down low, you can get it in close, you can incorporate, you can bring in all sorts of other elements into the picture. You can isolate it, you can choose your lens angle, and you know and it's effortless, and what you're seeing is what you're going to get, and it'll look fantastic. You try and do the same shot with a proper camera, and you've got to move chairs out the way, you've got to bring in a tripod because it's going to be a slow shutter speed, and then you've got to think about what lens you're going to use and change lenses. It all becomes a palaver, and then the lighting's not good enough. Of course, the cameras, the little iPhone is working up, or the Samsung or what have you, is working super hard with its AI built in to balance things out, and it says, oh, I know you, this person's photographing a plate of food, so I know what to do with a plate of food. I know how to make it look great. And so you're working against all that stuff. So sometimes the technology and things like the phone makes you realize just how powerful photography is and how irrelevant it is having the camera up here. Mm-hmm. And how you can work with a camera below. And I think that's one of the best things for people photography, is just to get the camera lower.
So how do we avoid the looking up into people's noses when we have the camera, say, chest height or waist height? That's something that I hear often, is when we're looking straight up.
Yeah, it depends on the person you're photographing. Ultimately, if you photograph at eye height, photographs at eye height, and you want a full length picture, basically you've got to tip the camera down, mm-hmm. so that the head is in the top half of the picture, and you'll find that the head is just like big and their feet are tiny, right? And it's all distorted and it looks terrible, but that's what people do because they want to, I'll take a picture of you, and then they tip the camera down and take the shot. They focus and reframe and shoot, and it always looks appalling. If you keep the back of the camera upright, so the verticals are upright, and you shoot sort of midway up the body, so you're looking up to the face and down to the feet, it looks fantastic. So it's, I suppose it's a 10-year-old viewpoint is probably the best viewpoint for a lot of the photography of people. So
I gotta go ahead
take
and
a look
at
the next time you look at a movie, Netflix, Amazon Prime, whatever. You look at a documentary movie, just make a conscious note of how high the camera is in the piece, whether it's a documentary interview piece or whether it's a scene in a James Bond film or what have you. Just look at the camera height and the camera position, and you'll suddenly realize, he's got a point there, or what have you. Yeah. All right. So these creatives in Hollywood and in that film and TV industry, they really know, they suss things out. And there's a lot of tradition there which carries through because it's good. It works.
Right. Yeah. It's time tested for sure. Yeah. I got one last question here for you about light. And that is, you know, we talked about the importance of controlling light and being able to, come in and just create a scene. You know, we're going into a black box, say a hotel room, and then we start to introduce light itself. I want to know for you, what is the balance between, just killing all ambient light and creating a scene versus just adding that touch of light, say, you know, when a couple wants to take a photo next to a Christmas tree? How do you make that distinction?
Well, first of all, you've got to decide, is the ambient light lovely? You know, if you walk into a room, just think, oh, this is nice in here. Because if it is, great. That sets your exposure to get the ambient right. Then you've got to choose a position where the person you're photographing isn't being clobbered with some downlighter. So you've got to choose that position carefully. And you might be able to use a downlighter as a bit of a backlight, like the light that's on me here. And then you pop your key light in such a way that it doesn't destroy the background. I'm going to stand up and adjust this light. Just take a look at the curtains on the background.
Okay.
All right. So if I bring this key light, if I tip it up, can you see that?
Yes.
Right, that's control of light, okay? You don't want to just put light on the background.
Right.
You want to keep the light off the background and put the light where you want it. That's just control of light. All right, so it's a case of just being able, when you're working with hard light, you can do that. You can't do that. If I had a softbox here on me, I couldn't do that. It would just light the room, illuminate it.
Right.
And then I'd have no control. It would just rattle around everywhere and I wouldn't have that element of control.
Okay, I gotcha. So really, you know, one of the hardest things I think to teach in photography is figure out your artistic voice, right? Because there's a lot of different options, you know, on how to use light, from hard to soft to, you know, large light source to continuous to flash and all these things. And I think what it sounds like, what it comes down to, is you really have to use your eyes, make a decision, and then go based on that. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think so. I think if the work that you're doing, if your own personal photography, if it's not really fulfilling in the sense that you know it can be better, but you don't really know how, explore light. Now, it doesn't have to be complicated. It doesn't have to be hard. It can just be literally a speed light on a stand with some little barn doors or a snoot or something, and use that for a whole project. Let's say photograph the people in your neighborhood, perhaps the top 20 women in business in the town that you live in or something. Come up with some crazy project and then go off and photograph them. And when you invite someone to say, oh, I'm doing a project on the top 20 women in business in Wedmore or wherever you happen to live, people are going to say, oh, yes, I'm quite happy to be there. Come and photograph me. And so you have that opportunity. You might only need 10 or 15 minutes, but photograph them with that little snooted light or something, and then do each person in the same way. And then when you get to, when you've got your 20 people, put an exhibition on the local library or the local town hall or something, and the next thing you know, you've created a style, and it can only come, you know, it doesn't have to come from any more than a speed light, but you stick to a unique style and a way of shooting, and you maybe shoot it in black and white, or you shoot it all with an orange gel on the flash, and you give it a little bit of a warm glow, or maybe cool background and warm foreground, whatever, you know, come up with something that you like the look of, and you can practice on your family or your neighbors or your friends, and then try it out. Go out there and shoot a project, and that will be, you'll be such a steep learning curve, and you'll get to the 20th person, and you'll wish you reshot the first four or five because but that's all right. That's fine. Just let it go. You know, be comfortable with the work you're doing, but understand where you can get better, and that's all progress.
Yeah. Wow. Damien, I don't know. I really hope that somebody listening takes you up on that project and decides to go out and do that, because not only is that going to be real world experience behind the camera, but also get you out into your community and let others know that you are a photographer, and there's nothing wrong with that. So thank you so much for sharing that. Before I let you go, Damien, you know, we're at the end of our time. So people are listening, they're thinking, wow, there's a lot of great information here. I want to learn more from Damien. Where can we find you online?
Well, I think probably the best, well, there's a couple of places. I have a YouTube channel called Lovegrove Training. So it's YouTube.com/C/Lovegrove Training. Or Pro Photo Nut, that's my blog. It's just profotonut.com. There's, I think, about 500 pillar articles. I started the blog in 2008, so there's a lot of information there. And then there's Lovegrove Adventures. That's where I run workshops in America and Italy and places. So that they're there, but really the most important element, I think, is probably if you want to learn about lighting, go onto my YouTube channel and just watch some videos. There's great videos there for learning how to use speed lights out on location, out on the street, learning how to use continuous light and things like that. And on the blog, you'll find that if you're fed up with adverts on YouTube, you'll find that most of the titles that are on YouTube in full length are also on the blog. So we'll get the name you want of the video, and you can go and watch it on the blog, and it'll be advert free.
So much experience, that guy. Seriously, Damien, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing all that you did. You know, your insight, I think, is very different than a lot of what other photography educators share. But it's proven in your case. And, you know, we can see that, you know, maybe it's not always soft light and rainbows that we are searching for. I had three main takeaways from this episode today with Damien. The first one is not to be scared to experiment. You know, light is light. And it's not all the same, but it all has a use. So find out when to use hard light, when to use soft light, based on your preferences for your own photography. And the only way that you can do that is through actually doing, through experimentation. Takeaway number two that I had is try not to think about seeing light, but try to think of it as controlling light, right? Look for your light sources, see what you can do with them, and when you need more light, add it, right? Pretty simple. And my last takeaway here was that you can't make a decision tree when you use when to use light and how to build a shot because, well, only you can decide what you want the photo to look like. Then you just simply use the tools to build it. Really powerful takeaways. And do not forget to check out Damien's YouTube channel. Honestly, he has so much great information. He has a full, I think it's a 2.5 hour long behind the scenes of a wedding day where you're going to see him using light, where you're going to see him struggling with just the everyday challenges that you have at weddings. And he also has tons and tons and tons and tons of lighting tutorials on his YouTube as well. So the link to that is going to be in the show notes. Highly suggest that you check it out. And yeah, if you're driving, check out the link in the show notes. Well, if you've got any questions about today's episode or feedback on the show, I would love to hear from you. Feel free to reach out to me directly via the contact page over at beginnerphotographypodcast.com. That is where you can shoot me an email or even better, a voicemail. Yeah, brand new technology. These voicemails let me hear from you directly in your own words, which is, I think, a lot more powerful than, you know, just reading the typed words that you put on a computer over the internet, right? That's why I like having these conversations in a podcast rather than just reading people's blog posts, because I want to talk to you. I want to hear from you. And while you are there at the website, be sure to check out and grab my free Picture Perfect camera settings cheat sheet. I've got camera settings for more than 10 popular types of photography filled with my personal and professional images, and then the real life camera settings that I used to capture those images so that you know how to get started. Well, that is it for this week. Thank you again for tuning in to this episode of the Beginner Photography Podcast brought to you by CloudSpot, which truly is the easiest way to deliver and sell your photos online. You can learn more about CloudSpot by heading over to deliverphotos.com. And remember, the more that you shoot today, the better you will be tomorrow. Talk soon.
Thank you for listening to the Beginner Photography Podcast. If you enjoy the show, consider leaving a review in iTunes. Keep shooting, and we'll see you next week.